This Hedge School series of podcasts is brought to you by History Ireland Magazine and the Wardwell Group. For more information or to subscribe, visit historyireland.com.
Well, good afternoon, history lovers, and welcome to the latest History Ireland Hedge School. Our topic here today is Colum Kill, 1500, Man, Myth and Memory. Columba, or Colum Kill, was born 1500 years ago in Garton, County Donegal, and claimed descent from the legendary High King of Ireland, Niall of the Nine Hostages. He entered the church, became a missionary evangelist, and is credited with spreading Christianity to Scotland. In particular, he founded the Abbey on Iona, which became the dominant religious and political institution in the region for centuries. He died there, aged 75, in 597. But what do we know about Colum Kill, the man? How much of what we know is based on subsequent myth and legend, and how has he been remembered over the centuries? So to discuss this and related matters, I'm joined by the Reverend David Hulton, Rector of Conwell Union and Garton, and on my immediate right, Brian Lacey, author of Adamnan, Union, Life and After Life of a Donegal Saint, published by Four Course Press just this year, and our copies, of course, available in the lobby. And finally, on my left, Helen Meehan, local historian and genealogist and a regular contributor to the Donegal Annual. I'd also like to acknowledge the support of Donegal County Council's Heritage Plan. To get us started, Brian Lacey, could I go to you? I'm paraphrasing John Wayne from The Quiet Man. He sees Maureen O'Hara in the distance and he says, "Is that real?" this is a difficult question to ask in front of a whole crowd like this, like, but is Colum Kill a real person?
Yeah, you wouldn't like to start with an easier question. No, in fact, we can be very absolutely certain Colum Kill is a real person.
Thank God for that.
Now, there have been an awful lot of fictions told about him, written about him in all sorts of ways, but he himself was, without any doubt whatsoever, a real historical figure.
How do we know?
We know that partly because of himself, actually. We know that he goes to Scotland and he founds the monastery of Iona, probably in the year 563. We should say there are complications about all these dates, and maybe we come back to that, but for the time being, that's, he goes and he founds the monastery of Iona in 563. And one of the very first things the monks do when they get there, he himself probably, but certainly his monks that are with him, they begin recording details. Which like kind of newspaper headlines, you know, such and such a battle, such and such a king died, or such and such a church was. They're very short, pithy statements. And this seems to be, had begun basically as a way of keeping abreast of events back home. They're now in Scotland, and they, and that, those little notes that they recorded eventually grow into what we call the Iona Chronicle. And later on, several hundred years later, the Iona Chronicle grows into what we call the Irish Annals. And the Irish Annals are the basic tool that historians use to reconstruct the early period. Now, there may have been similar chronicles elsewhere in Ireland, and for that matter in Scotland, but if there were, they don't survive. And indeed, the Iona Chronicle itself doesn't survive, except as quotations in the later annals. But because the later annals record these things, we're now able to, as it were, reconstruct the Iona Chronicle. And from that, we can see without any doubt that Colum Kill himself was a real historical person, and we can learn some of the facts of his life. Now, there are a huge amount of stories and fictions elaborate about him, which is another case altogether. But the basic facts are indisputable.
Okay, now, the only thing about that is, you're talking about Iona, right? And if somebody comes to prominence in their later life, how can you pinpoint when they're born? Because they've not yet become famous.
Yeah.
Maybe I'll bring in David, you in that one, right? Because you're the Garden, your parish, right?
It is.
And it's commonly held that that's where Colum Kill was born.
It is. And I wanted to answer what Brian was saying as well, that I may tell from my accent that I'm not from around here. And I was raised in a St. Columba's church in what would have been, at his time, the southern end of Northumbria, so the banks of the River Humber, which is, of course, where the monks went after Scotland to try to convert the pagan English. And we have the after effects, shall we say, the echoes of his life and the reality there in history, in fact, in solid stone and brick. And we have a lump of iron and rock.
I think they acknowledge the true relation between the two islands.
Yes. Well, part of it, we're dependent on you for our salvation. It's quite an amazing thing. Yeah, the Garton, of course, there are various sites in Garton, and as Brian's already said, there's you can have quite, I think you said once, there's two opinions about everything in Ireland.
The split.
There's always a split. But yeah, but the bus splits are in Garton. There is an ancient hill fort, which is where you saw the picture of the ancient Columba Abbey. There, that's just on the edge of what was an ancient fort. You can see the embankment still there. It was obviously an important place. And as his father would have been the responsible for the local areas, the royalty, and it's very likely to be the place where he was from within Garton itself.
Now, is there evidence for that, Brian?
Careful. Yeah. Oh no, I have to say, as it will become apparent, since I'm sitting beside a clergyman, and when you're talking about saints, there's always a devil's advocate, and I'll be the devil's advocate today. And I'm very sceptical of almost every story about Colum Kill, but the one I'm not sceptical at all about is his birth in Garton. Now, whether it was in that field or at that rock or the other rock, it's another question. But I have no doubts. All the logic, all the historical evidence points towards Garton. And can I just add one little bit to that? Because David was talking about his father. But his mother is very important in this story. Columba's mother's name, according to tradition, is Ethna. And she herself was later honoured as a saint as well. In fact, her grave, which is, I have to say, very unlikely, but her grave is pointed out in a group of little islands in Scotland called Garvellas, where she is honoured as a saint. And her name is Ethna. Now, of course, Ethna was also the name of a very important territorial goddess in Ireland, all over Ireland. There are rivers and things named, you know, the Inn in County Westmeath and things like that. So it's very hard, when we say that Columba's mother was Ethna, it's very hard to know, is that really historically correct? Or is that some sort of harking back to a pagan goddess? But, such as the evidence is, there are many stories about where she comes from, and people in the audience may have heard them. She's from Wexford, she's from Leinster, she's from Fermanagh. But there's one piece of evidence which is often overlooked, that she comes in the text, which is repeated in several manuscripts between about the 12th century and the 16th century, that she comes from Fanad, from the Fanad Peninsula, or a greater Fanad Peninsula, let's say, which I think actually included a kingdom of Fanad, which included Garton. And that piece of evidence, again, you know, supports, and the geographical logic and all the stories point very strongly. So while I might dismiss a lot of other stories about Colum Kill, that's the one that I put money on, that he was born in Garton.
And what about the claims of then Colum Kill?
I've heard nothing.
And the point is, if there's no direct evidence, what's the basis for the connection, the claim?
There's no suggestion that Colum Kill is born in Glen Colum Kill at all. In fact, Sean Beattie's in the audience, and the last edition of the Donegal Annual, which Sean's the editor of Donegal Annual, has an article by, I think it's by Lachlan McGill, sort of disputing any connection between Colum Kill and Glen Colum, but that's another story. But there's no evidence that there's no suggestion anywhere that Colum Kill is born in Glen Colum Kill. His association with Glen Colum Kill, it comes at a later stage. When he's an adult and a cleric, you know. But the Garton area, and this is one that to me, one of the most charming things about the garden area is virtually every field in the garden area, between Kilmaur Crennan and Garden, virtually every field has a story about Columbkill or a monument associated with St. Columbkill or something or other, Holy Well or whatever it is. And they all focus on Columbkill as a baby and as a young child. So
Helen, I want to bring you in here, right? Because there is a consensus in discussion, there's continual conflict between hard evidence and myth and legend and so on. But the point is, even if these stories are myth and legend, why has the memory of Columbkill, why is it so strong? Why has it been kept alive? In other words, it must be based on something.
Well, the memory of Columbkill is based not on a single factor, but on a combination of factors. They would include writings already referred to, oral tradition, church dedications, or recently commemorations. And also the fact that Iona is still a site of religious pilgrimage and a place of reverence. Now, the commemorations are the events that today are best known about Columbkill. But the earliest of those was only held in Garten in 1897. So we wonder what happened in the years between 597 and 1897 to keep the memory alive.
Just put it there, Helen. You're saying that only in 1897, right?
Yes. It was the first organized commemoration.
Well, that's very interesting. You know, okay, so it's quite a recent phenomenon.
Commemorations as such.
Yeah. That's the name of a tradition. It's nearly always invented by somebody.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. No, well, the first, the idea of a commemoration was first mooted at the Dairyman's Association dinner in Glasgow in 1896. They proposed that they should do something for Columbkill. And that's when the idea came up. And the idea took off then. Anywhere that had associations with Columbkill, such as Durrell, Hollywood and County Down, even in America, the Irish societies there rode in behind. And that's when then the commemorations organized type of commemoration first started. Garten is the most remembered because it lasted for 3 days. And Bishop O'Donnell was very much rode in behind. He was a young bishop, very ambitious to promote the Gaelic culture and the commercial side as well. He was very interested in, say, the congested district board and things like that. So anything he organized, he really went to town to look at.
Ted, I was going to come back to commemorations towards the end of our discussion, because I want to flesh out the man himself first, right? I mean, just hold that thought, Helen, for a minute. Brian, just go back to you, right, about what do we know about, from whatever source, right, his early clerical education? I mean, he clearly was a connected gap, right?
Yeah.
I mean, would it be correct to describe him as, by the standards of time, aristocracy?
Oh, without any doubt. Now, again, there's a huge amount of propaganda and fiction, you know, that he himself could have become King of Ireland and all this sort of thing. Now, I'm afraid none of that is true. But he belonged to the family Tenniel Cunnell, of course, given their name to Tír Cunnell. And Tenniel Cunnell was one of the most powerful families in Ireland, without any doubt. And their kingship, based it largely in the lower Finn Valley, the good land of Eastern Gaul, you know. I'm sure we don't have to tell people in this audience, but in other parts of Ireland, people never think there's any good land in Donegal. It's all mountains and bog. But of course, East Donegal is excellent land. And indeed, the Ordnance Survey, 19th century, the Ordnance Survey recorded that the excellent land of East Donegal is caused by the flooding of the River Finn, which throws out muck. And the muck becomes then the... And this is, if you remember back to, this is the basis of the civilizations of the Nile. That's how, you know. So East Donegal was extremely good land, extremely rich agriculturally, and produced the most important families, if you like, an aristocracy in this part of the world. And they went up the ladder, had their own kingdom, but dominated Donegal, and eventually go on to obtain the kingship of Tara. Now, what was the kingship of Tara in the 6th century? That's a debatable point. It certainly wasn't the monarchy of Ireland in the way, say, the Queen of England is queen of everything, you know. But nevertheless, the kingship of Tara was a very powerful, dominating, royal, institution. And Colin Kent's family were part of that. The three of the first kings who were actually called kings of Ireland, although it's probably an exaggeration, come from that family. And Colin Kent was.
They're contenders for the High King.
Oh, they are absolutely. Sixth, seventh, and early eighth century, after that, their power declines. But in the sixth, seventh, and eighth century, they're amongst the most powerful people on the island of Ireland.
So what do we know about Colin Kent's early clerical education?
Well, we know very little. Adam Naum, who of course writes about him 100 years later, tells us a number of things. That he was educated by a monk, a Christian cleric called Finian. Now, Finian is a man of great mystery. In fact, he may actually be British. I was going to say English, but he'd be too early for England. He's probably a British figure who is a cleric. And then we are also told that he is educated under a cleric called Gemon. And Gemon, there's all sorts of kind of Gemon, you know, there's a sort of hint in the literature about Gemon that Gemon might be a kind of a druid as well, or some sort of crossover between a pre-Christian and a Christian. But one of the other things I want to say is that the headquarters of the Kendal Cunnel was at a hill, now nobody looks at it anymore, called Crohanhill. And Crohanhill lies roughly, it's a ridge, roughly between Castlefin and Lifford. About 3 miles long, but 1.5 miles wide. And that was the tower of Donegal. That was their headquarters. And at the base of that hill, if you go look at it even now, at the base of that hill, it's ringed by a number of ancient churches, of which I think only one survived in use. That's Dunnockmore Church of Ireland, near Castlefin. And according to the legends, Dunnockmore was founded by St. Patrick. Now, it's legend, but it's a very early legend, very early legend. And it seems to me as if this royal hill, if you like, Crohan, was surrounded at a very early stage by early Christian churches, Dunnockmore probably the principal of them. And I would imagine myself that Colin Kidd, that Dunnockmore may have been, although again, this isn't noted anywhere, I think Dunnockmore, chances are that was one of the places where you would have encountered Christianity for the first time.
Now, you mentioned the Finian there. Is that Finian of Moville? Or is it a different Finian?
Well, he's a... David.
What I want to get on to is what most people know about is this row with Finian of Moville over the salt. So, what's the story here?
Well, yes, the story is, of course, that he was a bright student loving the scriptures, made a copy of it of Salta, which had been under the ownership of Finian, and then he wanted to take it, and Finian said, "No, it belongs to me because it's a copy of mine," and that, of course, led to some conflict, they say. Now, whether it's true or not, I don't know. There probably was a battle between the northern and southern O'Neills, but whether it was.
The two parties then were part of. I mean, whether it's true or not, we can come back to that. Never let me assume the very good story, as we historians say, because it's a very good story, right? Mm. But having a row over a salter is one thing, right? How can it lead to a battle? I mean, I'm presuming then that each represented a political unit of some sort.
Well, I'm not the expert, I'm sure Brian will say something about that, but obviously he was a royal prince with a. Connections and may not have been particularly flexible when it came to what he wanted, shall we say, like many leaders are. So that I can quite imagine people of that type could get into the situation where they felt very aggrieved and wanting to fight over it. I was going to say that I think whether or not it's true, it's interesting that we have that sort of story because most of the saints in the medieval time had sanitized.
Yeah, so it's a pretty, so he's responsible for the story for the deaths of all those people in this battle.
Yeah, or at least starting a battle in which lots of people died, but not he actually killed, he didn't want to kill them himself. But yet, you can imagine it escalating. But it's interesting, isn't it, that often states have sanitized backgrounds, and when you read the annals, it's all great things and all sorts of wonderful things that happened and misses out the downside. Whereas, in, say, for instance, in the scriptures, if you read in the Old Testament, look at people like Abraham or David, they all have things to do which are very much human and very much not the sort of thing you really would be doing if you were kind of a medieval saint, theoretically. So it wouldn't be too surprising. Think about King David had somebody's husband killed in a battle in order to have her as his wife. So
that sounds like the fact that he provoked a battle, right? Given what
he wants
Brian
to.
Said about his political connections, that seems pretty credible to me. In other words, that seems more credible than some saintly saint.
Yes, you know, and about the copyright law as well, that sounds not the sort of thing that would be concocted from nowhere. It does sound like a credible piece of evidence of something that really happened.
And who adjudicated on that? Who adjudicated on this dispute?
Well, yeah. Brian, come on, you can tell us all the details now.
Well, in the story, and I have to say, I reserve, you know, in the story, the Colin Kill copies the book, and the owner of the book doesn't like that, and so he says, the copy is now mine. And Colin Kill is furious, so he refers the matter to the High King in Tara, and the High King pronounces, in the story, I have to keep emphasizing in the story, the High King pronounces the famous judgment, Lagat Bo, Bunninus, Lagat Laura, Laura, to every cow it's got, to every book it's copy. Therefore, the copy belongs to the original book. And Colin Kidd loses out, and he then in a fury goes back and tells his family, and the family go to war over. No. That's the story.
So the war happens after the adjudication.
Oh yes, the adjudication.
Okay, so he doesn't accept he doesn't recognize the court.
Yeah.
Okay, part of the story. I'm gonna keep going with this for a bit.
Yeah.
So he has his blood in his hands, right? And is that the reason then he goes into exile? I mean, is that the way it's represented?
Well, that's the way it's represented, isn't it?
Yeah.
Right.
It's certain, but because it was almost certainly a very godly man, very studious, had good royal connections, but there was a lot of interchange between southern Scotland and north of us, now Ireland, at that time anyway. So
that's what I was going to say, is he the exile? Or is that part of their world anyway? That's a good side point.
Because he does come back, it seems he does actually come back several times, whether he came back blindfolded or with sods on his stamped
feet. Well, I first heard the story, right, in fourth class in the De La Salle School here, Brother Fidelis, right? I'm sure there's one of you in the audience. He best described as old school, right? I still have scars on him. But they do these things that stick in a child's mind, this idea of this guy blindfolded with sods under his feet, coming into the council from Cat, I even remember that, right? So, like, what's the basis for that? I mean, presumably, when was that story first told? That's about that.
Yeah.
If I rephrase the question.
Well, I have to say, I am utterly, totally skeptical of the story. There is no evidence.
Helen, do you want to adjudicate this now?
Well, I do agree with what you said about fourth class in National School, because that is how the story, the back of the book, is the one thing that a lot of people know about Colin Kill. And it's a thing people always remember about him. And I suppose the teacher throws the idea home too, that the books were very important, and that look at the battle could even be thought about a book. And I think that has sort of stayed with people when they've forgotten all the more technical details and all the more historical facts. And that is why, I don't believe, of course, in the story, because I think it wasn't mentioned until the Black Book of Malaga, which was about the year 800, is the first time it is actually written about the battle. But there would have been contention between the northern and the southern Enail anyway. And the idea of the southern Enail going north and the northern and the meeting under the sea there at Benbulbin, that is very credible. There was another very famous battle, of course, fought there later.
Just go back there. You're saying that this story, true or not as it may be, is first mentioned in 800.
Yeah.
Now that's a long, long time ago. That's pretty close to this alleged event. So even if it never happened, it's still history. Isn't it? From 800 anyway, please.
Well, yes, but those years between, before that, why was it never mentioned in those years?
Yeah.
And then it suddenly appeared in a book at that stage. The Black Book of Malaga, I forget which book it was actually then published.
But it raised the question that why would it suddenly appear? Do you know what I mean? If there was no basis to it at all, right? You know,
only seven.
Yeah. Well, there were two other battles that were mentioned as well, but they have been discredited.
Yeah.
One of them was around Coleraine, wasn't it?
Yeah, Coleraine.
Yeah. Coleraine, yeah. And then it was
Battle
discovered.
Of the Three Coons.
Yeah, and it was discovered then that it was, the dates didn't tie, so it
right.
was sort of dropped.
So the thing, the point, what Alan's saying is, though, it isn't in the record for a long time, right? Regardless of the origin.
Okay, can I come to that? You know, history happened a long time ago, but we're looking at it backwards from now. And the early history of Donegal, the whole history of Donegal, including everything, almost everything to do with Colin Kill, has been utterly distorted. I'm now going to make my life very difficult with this audience. I don't understand how many O'Donnells are in the audience. But our ideas of Donegal history, early Donegal history, have been utterly distorted by the propaganda, medieval propaganda of the O'Donnells. They reconstructed, they rewrote, they Stalinized this. Stalin could have learned nothing from the O'Donnells.
The future is certain, the past is very
unbelievable. But just, there was a battle. There was a battle of Kildrevin, that's undisputed. What it was about and who took part in it is another day's work. As Helen says, it isn't mentioned. There's no description of it for several hundred years after it's alleged to have happened. And then we begin to get the odd hint of it. But in fact, the full story as we know it, now know it, as David outlined it there, really only occurs for the very first time in Manus O'Donnell's Baha Comitula of 1532. Before that, I wrote them down just so that I wouldn't forget it. You can see a kind of a literary evolution of the story. There's a battle. Then we get in a text called the Celtiker Gradationes Sancti Colombo, which is in the Codex Insulensis of about 1400. We get the story of the battle. We get the story of the copying of the book, but not the full story of the judgment by the king and then the battle as its cause. And then somewhat later in the Donegal manuscript of the early 16th century, the Lord Clunia Swivna, there's a text called The Cockpool of Drevna, and that gives us the story of the copying of the book and the judgment, but not as a reason for the battle. And it's only with Manus O'Donnell in 1532 that we get the full story. And it's like as if you were asked to reconstruct the history of the Cold War between the Soviet Union and the West, well, you wouldn't go to the novels of James Bond. And that's the sort of situation you have. We have a wonderful piece of medieval fiction which has lots and lots of elements in the story. But it's a piece of fiction. It's not the original, it's not history. And one of the reasons we think, now this is only kind of a late idea that's come to fore in the last 10 years or so, is the story of the copyright, you know, is fascinating. You know, it's a fascinating idea. Even now there's, you know, complications about copyright. But we think that story emerged from the latest invention of the time. Now we're talking about 1532. So what was the latest invention of the time? The printed book. And once printing happened, that caused complications about copyright, just as in our world, the invention of the computer and so on and so forth, and the internet has caused complications. So we think that story about the copyright is really a reflection of the invention of the printing press. Now, as David said, I think, you know, you said, David, that there must have been something there, a pearl of a story or something, going way back.
Have you never heard of it before? That no previous documentation you have.
No, but there must, but I take absolutely accept your point. There must have been something there. But now, I mean, if modern copyright law, in Britain and Ireland, modern copyright law begins in 1710. There's an act of Queen Anne of 7, and that's the first act of the British Parliament, which applies in Ireland, of copyright. Now, even if we're only talking about a story of 1532, That's still 200 years before the first legislation. But I'm afraid, well, at least in my opinion, the story of the copyright is 16th century fiction, not 6th century history.
I tell you, I want to move on to my own in a second, right, where we'll be hopefully on more solid ground. But before I do, Helen, can I go back to you, right, about the sort of powers and miracles that were attributed to him. And I'm thinking, another story I remember at the depths of my memory is the spreading the cloak. What's that about? Just give me that story.
Well, it's a story I haven't concentrated much on. His powers now, I would think there were two elements there. There was powers, divine powers that he got from God, like sanctifying wells, and then that the water was used for cures. And then there was also the powers that were believed to have come from the pagan gods. The people of the time moved sort of the powers from the Christian that the pagan gods had to the saints. And saints were famous for something now, for example. We wouldn't think very saintly, person and person matches and that type of thing. So,
still a long tradition of that.
Yeah. And they believed that the saints had power over the elements, like the sea, the wind, the water, and that type of
thing. So they'd appropriate the pagan.
Pagans, yes. And
bring them into the Christian story. Them,
over into the Christian story. And they also believed that the saints, and especially Colin Kelly, had a power. I'm not sure what the right word for it is, but it would be some type of telepathy. Not only could he foretell the future, he could know what was going on in other places at that time, and that other people could know when he was in difficulty. And that's illustrated by a story that at one time, Colin Kelly and some others were coming from Iona to Derry, and their car was pursued by a fierce sea monster, and it was in danger of being swallowed. And this a friend, Colin Kelly, sent Senna up on the shores of Lough Erne. He was a smith, and he could see what was happening and the danger. And in his hand, he had his tongs and a piece of red hot metal, and he flung that in the northern direction, and it actually landed into the mouth of the monster, and he killed it. And the monster then floated ashore after it, and they opened the dead monster, and they retrieved the metal. And they made three bells from the metal. And these bells were very famous, the bell of Nall, the bell of Senna, and the bell of Tiernach. And there's some dispute too about who the actual bells were. Bells were important at the time. They were sort of a sign of authority. So it shows that the power that this power Colin Kelly had, that he could see other things and that others could see the difficulties he was in. And that's the type of powers that people attributed to him.
Sounds like a script from Game of Thrones. now, Iona, Brian, I mean, we're on solid ground here. The point is that I did make the suggestion that, you know, Iona was part of the Kingdom of Valyria, I think.
Yeah.
So it's part of their world, and so on, right? And this brings us to Adamnon, right? And, you know, we're interested in the book out there in the lobby for sale. I mean, is Adamnon really the guy we should be talking about here? Did he invent Colin Kelly?
Well, to some extent, he was a kind of a PR spokesman for Colin Kelly. Some people in the audience might be familiar with the difference between or the relationship between Socrates and Plato. You know, we don't have anything that Socrates wrote, or effectively nothing Socrates wrote has survived. So we only know about Socrates because Plato wrote about him. And it's somewhat similar with Colin Kelly. Now, not absolutely. We would know some things about Colin Kelly if Adamnon had never lived. But we know most about him because Adamnon wrote the great book.
How much later is this one?
About 100 years.
Something similar was happening back then, right, about Colin Kelly. So that's not that far. That's one hand gesture.
Yes, but indeed, Adamnon may have written the Vita Sancti Columbae as a centenary commemoration
of Columba. Agamemnon, in Agamemnon, in his text, and in this early surviving manuscript of it, which is in Switzerland now, there is, in small letters, the scribe wrote in small letters to distinguish it, there's a quotation from an earlier book about Columba, written also by another Donegal man, a man called Cumaina Finn, from roughly kind of Falkara kind of area, roughly speaking. But that doesn't survive, except as the quotation from it.
Yeah, you're talking about like written evidence now, albeit secondary.
Cumaina dies in the year 669, and Cumaina had written a book about Colum Kill before he died. So that's taken us back another, if you like, 50 years closer to the man himself. And then Agamemnon comes along, and around about 700, roughly speaking, 100 years after the death of Colum Kill, he writes this big book, which is one of the great, great pieces of European literature. I mean, the fact that it's about Colum Kill is of interest to us here locally, but it's one of the major items of European literature in Latin of its day.
I mean, what does he say? You know, I mean, like, how would you characterize what the picture he draws of Colum Kill?
Well,
what's he trying to do?
Shortly, there had been a big row in England, in Northumbria, where David comes from, about 50 years earlier, about the date. How do you calculate the date of Easter?
Yeah.
Now, this is something that seems ludicrous to us now, but it was a huge thing in the early Middle Ages. How do you calculate the date of Easter? And there were rows about it. And the Irish, and particularly Iona and Columbkill's monasteries, lost out. And at the famous Synod of Whitby, in David's hometown, which I shouldn't be talking about, the vote went against Columba and Iona. And so Agamemnon comes along.
Justifying their position,
having lost the argument.
I think Iona continued following the Irish system for a long time, didn't he?
Yeah.
The traditional system, it was only eventually with Iona. Did he actually ever convert, or was it just that it was a move by the Vikings? And so then did they ever change their dates of Easter?
Oh, they did, But what we know, and David, I invited to put a question to David, because we tend to know about Colum Kill's influence in Scotland.
Yeah.
We're not as well aware of the influence in the north of England, particularly Northumbria.
But
that was very big, wasn't it?
I want to talk about Iona, because it seems to me that that is Colum Kill's biggest legacy, is what's founded there. And of course, it has a whole momentum and history of its own. Mm-hmm. Dave, just talk to us about Iona. How important was it? What was its geographical reach like?
Well, that's a good question. It really did seem to be, primarily, of course, it was Scotland and Picts, wasn't it? St. Aidan came to northern England because the work was going on in Scotland, there was a bit of a problem going on in Britain. The Anglo-Saxons arrived. So by the middle of about 600, just after Columba died, the south and the east of Britain was now occupied by various tribes and different kingdoms of the Anglo-Saxons, who eventually became the English once they all merged together. And they were mostly pagan, and they must have come to the attention, I guess, at that point of Iona, because they were encroaching into what's now Scotland on the east. And so I think there was a previous monk sent to become bishop in York, which was an ancient see, a very ancient. The first one of the bishops of York involved in the Nicene Creed, so that goes way back. And of course, Constantine was in York when he heard that the previous emperor had gone. So there's an ancient tradition. Somebody was sent there. Didn't go down very well. Very stickler. So eventually, Aidan was sent, and he was much more
from Iona.
And they established a similar thing in what's called Lindisfarne, the holy island of Lindisfarne, which is still there, which was near one of the ancient big kingdoms' main capital castles. It's a huge castle in Bamburgh, worth going to see. And the king there at that time had converted. He was a Christian, unlike many. And Oswald, he became a saint. He had actually studied in Iona, so it had a big influence because of the educational side.
He's on the cover of History Ireland, by the way, in the last year. Check out that story.
Yep. And so
just bring you back to go back to Colin Kerr, right? I mean, in my introduction, you know, I credit him with, you know, evangelizing Scotland. Right? Is that true? I mean, can we say that Scotland was Christianized from Iona?
Well, the Scots certainly believe so, don't they? Many, although many were Christians, because of course not all the Celts were out of Scotland. There were still Celtic people. Many of them would have been Christians in the first place.
I think there were other clerics involved. In fact, I heard a lecture by Elva Johnson from UCD the other night, which she gave in Belfast, and that's what she was talking about, the other saints involved. But Colm, it's a bit like here in Donegal and in Scotland. Colmkill is so overwhelmingly important.
Well, that's important. Like Patrick, isn't it? I mean, we now know that Ireland
was
evangelized
by many others.
But he was given the credit and
respect.
So it's a similar case.
But again, back to the parent. I mean, he only got the credit because, in a sense, they were deeply involved originally. I mean, but if you like, his importance grows. And the others retire into anonymity, as it were.
Exactly.
So, okay, I want to go back to Helen, because you started talking about the commemoration earlier. You just pick up that discussion again, because we've moved on in terms of his legacy as a family of Iona. Iona then, you know, has his influence right in the north of England, Scotland, along with other people.
And it does, if I may say so, it does knock on, because one of the converts who studied at Lindisfarne, Wilfred, went on to do more, plan to look at a lot of evangelism. In fact, Oswald the King also helped with evangelism work in the north of England. And then from him, then we have Willibrord, who was actually not from Northumberland as well, converts. He went back to the Anglo-Saxons in what's now Holland and north of Germany. And then the southern English converts, Boniface, was also from a royal line. He actually did a lot of work right across the German areas, which, of course, the Anglo-Saxons were Germans, and the ancient language is very similar to German. And I've actually lived or studied in some of the places, and you keep these names keep popping up. And these are all part of the emphasis of Columbus.
That's a huge
mission.
That's a massive
right across the north of Europe.
Yeah.
Could I just add one thing just about this influence in England?
Mm-hmm.
Because as I say, we kind of tend to take Scotland for granted. But England, we have the genealogy of Colin Kill's family, who his mother and father were his brothers and sisters. That genealogy survived in only one place. And do you know where that place was? Durham Cathedral.
Right.
If it hadn't survived in Durham, we wouldn't know. Now, Durham Cathedral, the great Anglo-Norman cathedral in Durham, was the direct kind of institutional descendant of the original monastery in Lindisfarne. And when the Vikings came, the monks moved to the mainland and eventually they settled in.
Just like
in Durham.
Ireland were brought back to mainland Ireland.
Yeah. But right through the Middle Ages, there was a big devotion to Colm Kill in Durham. And Durham preserved many of the relics associated with Colm Kill. Many of the most important manuscripts associated with some which are now in the British Library. But Durham, you know, you don't tend to think of Durham as being important. Durham is huge in the Colm Kill story. If they hadn't preserved the stuff,
and the Celtic one,
huge stuff,
you wouldn't know. The Christians in Northern England still, you find Celtic boots and so on.
Now, you mentioned relics, right? As we've been talking here about the veracity of various bits of evidence.
He interrupted to talk to Helen about
it. Just on the question of relics, right? I mean, the most famous, you know, relics of the True Cross, right? But if every relic of the True Cross is true, you know, he's crucified in the Forest of Trees, right? You know, so I mean, how many of these relics of Colm Kill are genuine, or does it matter? What's a relic to be talking about?
Well, I'm not a relic man, so.
Well.
I mean, that'd be cases where relics have been placed in the box and then they open them up centuries later.
I mean,
there's nothing inside.
I mean, not by my previous parish was in a place called Gardgrave, not Gartan. That was in North Yorkshire. And we had, when they rebuilt the church in the 1800s, after the foundations, they found parts of the old Celtic crosses, which must have been originally where, because originally the monks would come round, there'd be crosses erected, and they'd come round and they'd say Mass, and preach, and baptise, and then they'd move on. And that's probably done in the field, which eventually became the churchyard. And when it was churches were built, one of the first stone churches probably built round about the Norman time, and it was Catholic saint, the St. Bob's. Came Catholic into Northern England. So you had this history, continuous history, and we had the board, wooden board with all the names of all the rectors down to me, and took them to the Reformation, where the same guy stayed there. There's no great change of the bishop sent a new prayer book to say, look, the Protestants now read this.
yes.
And so, yeah, it's continuous. You know, you've got these foundations, you've got these ancient pieces of history going back to the back to very early.
Now, this I want to go back to Helen, right? Because you're implying a continuity, right?
Yeah, a continuity.
But Helen, you were saying earlier, right, that when it comes to commemoration, it only starts like in the 1890s or sometime. Why? What's the gap about the silence? What's happened here?
Well, the idea of that kind of any type of commemoration wasn't so common then. The idea of commemorations only came up. Coming in for various things as you went into.
So that's more to do with the development of an organized modern society. Transport and tourism and
Before that, the memory of Cotton Kill was kept alive by the writings already.
I mean, it's similar thing that people going to Wolf Tom's Grave, for example, in Bulmester.
The invention of the train. An awful lot of these things
happened. That's true.
So just going back to the first one you mentioned there, it was 1897.
Yes.
Who's behind that? Who's organising that?
Well, as I said, it was first mooted at the Dairyman's Association dinner in Glasgow. That was an annual event, the dinner the idea took on, and all the places that had Cotton Kill associations, like Durrell, Hollywood, and County Down, actually, when they were dedicating their new church in Hollywood, a stone was taken from Garton to be the foundation stone of the church in Hollywood. And they all organized some type of commemoration. Derry, they're based mostly on the Long Tower Church in Derry, it was mostly religious. In America, there were various Irish societies there organized commemorations as well. And Garton was the most famous because it lasted for 3 days. And there was a book then published called Kevin Colin Killa, Colin Kill's Memory. And it was put together, shall we say, it contained speeches and sermons and information. It was put together by Karen Weiger, who wrote the History of the Diocese of Revolt.
I tell you the question, is this an ecumenical operation?
It was, yes, there was.
Because I'm going to ask was, you know, was Colin Kill a Catholic or a Protestant? The reason I say that is because...
We didn't have those problems back then.
Because these sort of questions were asked by St. Patrick right up to the 1960s, right? Believe it or not,
I'm talking about the commemoration.
So it is ecumenical.
Yeah, and Iona, the Church of Scotland, the Presbyterians, and the Catholics all organised pilgrimages to the island of Iona at that time.
And that's remarkable given the politics of the time.
Yeah, it was. Yeah, it seemed. And then that was the first. Then the commemorations. There were others held in other years. 1961. Was a famous one because they had the Curra, that was built in Donegal, went from Derry, kind of followed along the coast, then eventually came to Iona, and it was welcomed there. The Archbishop of Canterbury was there, and representatives of the various churches, and they all went in a procession from where it landed, I think it was Martyrs Bay, from that up into the Abbey. By then, of course, the Abbey was in operation and a community based there again. had been donated, I think, wasn't it, the Bishop of the Duke of Argyll, donated it to the church on the condition that it had to, could be used or was to be used by all denominations that have access to use it.
Dave, do you want to comment on that? Because, I mean, of course, this is post-disestablishment of the Church of Ireland, right?
Yes.
I mean, that puts it...
Well, yes.
You know, but it puts it into a different context, I think. But, I mean, how important, then, is Colin Killer in the Church of Ireland tradition?
Well, the Church of Ireland would see ourselves as the church that has always been here.
Yeah.
You know, it wasn't as if at some point there was there's a new church. It just come, that's why the buildings are old. That's why it's just always been here. And so it's a bit of a strange split, isn't it? Because both the Catholic and the church would see themselves in continuity with the history. And it's a bit of a branching, but some of them are still very close. If you read the Mass and you read the Holy Eucharist, you wouldn't see an awful lot of differences. So he's just part of our history as much as is, of course, Patrick and all the others going back. So it's very important. And hence, was it in the early 60s? Was it 61 or 63?
63, yeah.
Yeah, the Archbishop of Canterbury and the Archbishop of Armagh, because Armagh is an ancient establishment, and the Church of England, which is a newbie on the scene there compared to Ireland. And I think all different denominations got together then as well. And I was speaking to Canon Crooks, whose father, Archdeacon Crooks, was the organizer of that just the other day. And he was a young lad, Canon Crooks, and I'm not quite as young as I am. Saying how a wonderful thing it was. And it was really, really important to remember these people who had such a huge impact. And of course, if you've got the English-speaking world, then of course he had a massive impact into the English-speaking world from the north, as well as St. Augustine from the south.
Can I tell you an anecdote just to go about that boat was made by Jim Boyd from Carrick Finn, and then sailed from Derry largely by Church of Ireland crew. But it was 1963, before television was available in the Western Isles, and the old world was still there, you know. And Canon Barry, one of the people who was on the boat, told me himself that they sailed from Derry and then up through the Isles eventually. And they landed at night time on various beaches and camped. And some of the local people almost thought that they were Colin Kill.
Kind of building on that, and that whole idea of the kind of Celto-Christian kind of faith that was kind of kept by the monks in Ireland, where the rest of Europe was falling apart. And that then conflict with the Roman influence kind of coming back. I wonder, is there any of those kind of older pagan traditions that ended up kind of being linked with, specifically with Columba, if you are aware of? Or
David, you want to step in that minefield?
We talk, you see, there's a lot of talk about the Celtic Church and the Roman Church. There's actually only two different ways of honouring God, shall we say. But in the Catholic Mass and a lot of the Catholic devotions were not standardised onto the Council of Trent in the 1500s. So in a lot of cities in Europe, for example, say Milan and Turin or whatever, you would have Mass, but there might be slight differences in the way it was celebrated, and slight differences in other minor things, not in articles of faith as such, but in other matters. And but the people now, there's no word about that now. The only, we keep talking about the Celtic Church and the Roman Church, as if they were the only two. Actually, there's a lot of small variations that aren't now talked about at all. But the other seems to be kind of played up and kept to the fore because it's a matter of different denominations now.
And I think it's worth saying that the church generally, Roman Catholic or others, always melds the presentation of the truth to the culture of the people that you're working with. and so you find very different expressions, say, in African countries. You might be very surprised to find you have to dance to the front to put the money in the collection plate rather than putting it in a box, for instance. And all sorts of things are different. And so there's this interaction between the truth and this context you're in. And I think that's so important, and there's a big influence. And of course, when Columbus was born, it wasn't long after Patrick, was it? Now, there was still a lot of paganism in the country, a lot of the ways of doing things, the cultural things, like the Druids training the princes. They just transferred into put the truth in, the Christian truth into it, and changed, but it was very similar culture. Maybe that's why...
Particularly here in Donegal, West Donegal. I suspect West Donegal wasn't converted until about 800, either. The concept of God, Lou was very big. Lou La Vaga is very big in West Donegal. And, I mean, there's all sorts of interlink. Like, for instance, what's the name of Lou La Vaga's mother? It's Ethna, the same name as the mother. And there's all sorts of stories that, you know, link the two individuals.
Now, this, we've looked at this now in detail. And is there anybody else in the audience who wants to come in? Because I'm going to wrap up here. Yeah, this one last question.
What about the Colin Field prophecy? I have a fellow John Arrow used to talk about the
mission of
Colin
Jordan
in one. Oh, yes. Yeah. Helen?
Well, Colin Field prophecies can be divided into different categories. Some of them are mundane events, talk about the time come when you won't know the difference in the summer and the winter, except the leaves and the
city.
Of course, nowadays that has become very topical. Others kind of foretell of the modern age, about the coming of the black pig through Garnet's Moor Gap, of course, in the north, the county of the sea came through Garnet's Bay, that the train came, and that type. Then there was a more historical type of prophecy. The ones say, for example, that Colin Kelly said that the day would come when an Aspagalda, that's a foreign bishop, would rule in his city of Derry. And that came to pass in 1606 when Bishop George Montgomery, the first bishop of the Reformed Church in the Northwest, was appointed Bishop of Derry. So then there was others that were made up a lot later, but they seemed to fill in. And one of them, just for a minute, one of them is that people believed at the time that a great war would be fought sometime before the end of the world. And they wondered when this war would be fought. And Colin Kelly was supposed to have been asked. And his reply was that it would be Idr Spal Agus Corran, that is between the scythe and the reaping hook. And the scythe, of course, stood for the haymaking of the summer, and the spal, the corran, was for the autumn corn season. But then, at that time, haymaking wasn't common at all in Celtic Ireland. In fact, it was only introduced by the Normans and never really came to Donegal or Ulster much until after the plantation. So, prefaces like that were made up, but they could be believed because they were sort of in the same vein as the ones that had been there already. And then, sometime about 1550 or 60, I think it was Kearney, was the name of a man that published a book on the prophecies of Colin Kelly and St. Malachy.
Nicholas Kearney.
On St. Malachy. And so it kind of kept the prophecies going when they would have probably died out a good bit, except in Irish speaking areas. But their publication in English kind of kept them alive. And it's the thing that most people hear about and talk about, not so much now. But even say, just 60, 70 years ago, was the prophecies of Colin Kelly, and people were talking about the prophecies of Colin Kelly that knew nothing about, well, it's about Colin Kelly. In fact, one of the collectors going around collecting folklore in the early 1920s said that he visited two old men and that they actually knew more about Colin Kelly than they did about William Cosgrove, that had just been recently appointed Prime Minister of the United States.
Now, just to finish up, David, this is an easy question. I mean, what do you view then as Colin Kelly's legacy for us today?
That is a very good question. I think a lot of the churches would hope that being pre-A divisions, that he would be a place of somebody we could all centre around, and his vision and his love of the scriptures through which God can speak to us even today, I think is one of the things we can all unite around. And his dedication to God, to the Lord Jesus, and his preaching of the love of God through Jesus' cross would also be something that all, another uniting factor for all the Christian churches. So that's really important as we're going forward now into the 21st century.
I tell you what, on that note, I think we'll wrap up. So I'd just like to thank everybody here today, Reverend David Hilton, Brian Lacey, and Helen Meehan, and all you people in the audience, particularly those people who made a contribution. Our next History Ireland Head School is going to be on the treaty, back to stuff closer to our time, and that'll be posted on its centenary, that'll be on Zoom, of course, and that'll be posted on the 6th of December, which is the exact centenary. Our next live Head School will be in the Chapel Royal, Dublin Castle, at 3 o'clock on Thursday, the 6th of January, 2022. That will mark the handover of Dublin Castle on the 16th of January 1922. So if you're in Dublin, might see you at that. So thank you very much for your attention this afternoon. Thank you.